I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point. On February 3rd, just before 9 p.m., a Norfolk Southern train derailed as it passed through the town of East Palestine, Ohio, a small community of about 5,000 residents on the border with Pennsylvania. The train was more than 1.7 miles long, 150 rail cars in total. Most were full of harmless goods, but 20 rail cars contained toxic chemicals, and 11 of those went off the tracks and emptied onto the ground, into the water, and burned off in billows of black smoke. And now, nearly 3 weeks later, residents are concerned about their health and frustrated with the lack of answers.
I came outside and I could see right away the main fire at the end of the street.
I seen all the smoke. The black smoke came out of East Palestine. You could stand at my house and see it. The billow that come up and it came down like a cloud, like a big black cloud.
It smelled like burnt almonds or vanilla.
Almost like a sweet smell.
A sweet smell. After a while, my head would start to hurt, or our nose would run and throat would burn. And then we knew that it was time to get out of town as fast as possible.
I'm very frustrated.
We don't think they're taking care of all the pollution that they should be.
We pass all of the creeks and there's crew after crew with white hoses and black hoses all through the creeks. They're not telling us why, and this is daily. I'm driving my children to school past all of this, and they're asking me questions that I don't have answers to.
Air-wise, I feel okay. Water-wise, no. No. There's just too many chemicals and stuff that were spilled that they still don't want to identify completely.
I honestly feel that the police department, the fire department, all the first responders, they don't have the answers to give us because I don't think they know. They're not getting the straight answers either.
The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency has said that among the chemicals being transported on the train was vinyl chloride. It's a cancer-causing substance in itself, and when it burns, it releases other chemicals which are also harmful to humans. Norfolk Southern was a no-show for a community meeting last week. The company said it was concerned about its representatives' safety. But yesterday, Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw toured East Palestine and told PBS he would focus on making the industry safer.
The National Transportation Safety Board, as you know, they're in charge of this investigation, and I'm very much looking forward to their results of their investigation. Once we have that, we're going to sit down and we're going to figure out what we could have done better. As you can imagine, every day since this occurred, I've been asking myself, what could we have done better? What could we have done to prevent this? So we are fully cooperating with the NTSB and the FRA on finding out what happened here. And we're going to make Norfolk Southern and the industry a safer railroad.
But as my guest today will tell us, making the industry safer has not necessarily been the primary goal of railroad companies over the last decades. Do I have that right, Rebecca?
That's correct. Railroad companies and their chief lobbying groups have fought relentlessly against virtually every safety measure proposed by regulators, particularly in the past decade. Norfolk Southern in particular has opposed requirements for braking systems that former regulators told us would have perhaps not prevented, but almost certainly mitigated the scope of the damage in East Palestine.
Rebecca Burns is with me, and also Julia Rock. They are journalists at The Lever and co-authors of a deep dive story covering the safety rules and regulations leading up to this most recent train derailment. Julia and Rebecca, thanks for joining us here on Point.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks, Kimberly.
So, yes, of course. So, Julia, can you tell us what The Lever is for our listeners who may not have read it?
Yeah, The Lever is a reader-supported investigative news site, and we cover all sorts of corporate malfeasance and the interactions between business and politics that are obviously coming up in this latest fiasco with Norfolk Southern.
And Julia, what caused you both to do this deep dive into the rail industry? Was this something that was you were working on before this derailment?
Well, we had been covering the negotiations last fall between the railroad industry and rail unions when ultimately Congress stepped in and passed a law preventing a rail strike. But in this situation, it was sort of interesting because, you know, there was this sort of big environmental disaster unfolding in East Palestine. You know, people were talking about chemicals being burned off. There were images of this big black mushroom cloud, and we weren't really seeing much news coverage of it. And we were sort of trying to figure out, like, how does a situation like this end up happening? And why is it sort of being treated like, you know, business as usual, which, as it turns out, it sort of is. There are more than 1,000 train derailments every year. But that was sort of what got us initially going on this story and digging into the company's history of fighting safety rules.
And Rebecca, what do we know now more about this particular accident? It's been 3 weeks, but it sounds like residents there are still concerned and that the people who are looking for answers haven't gotten them yet.
Right. Well, you know, the one thing that Shaw is perhaps correct in saying is that the accident still is under investigation by the National Transportation Safety Board. That said, we know a lot about persistent and structural issues about safety on the railroads. So in this particular incident, what we know so far from the NTSB is that it appears that a wheel bearing was in the final stages of overheat just before the train arrived in East Palestine. Video also showed that the train was on fire 20 miles before arriving in the town. Both of these issues sort of point to a fundamental problem here where we have longer and heavier trains, as we heard in the introduction here. This was a train that was nearly 2 miles long, being staffed by a crew of two people plus a trainee. So if you talk to rail workers, you know, what they'll often say is that what's surprising is not necessarily that this happened, but that it didn't happen more often. It doesn't happen more often. So after the, you know, the train derailed, we have, you know, we saw the initial decision to do what the industry term calls a controlled release of the vinyl chloride to burn it off. Residents have been told that it's safe to return home, but are still really waiting and have some really valid concerns. Vinyl chloride is a known carcinogen that can have a long latency period in between exposure and when people start to experience, you know, some really significant potential health effects. And we've heard a lot of reports thus far of people experiencing respiratory issues, skin irritation, you know, animals dying, fish dying has been documented by the Environmental Protection Agency. And so I think residents are really waiting for some clearer communication and need it specifically from the EPA and not from contractors hired by Norfolk Southern.
And I will say that we did reach out to Norfolk Southern. They were not able to provide us a representative to join us today, but they did send us links to comments that Alan Shaw, the CEO, and others have made in the media. But Julia, when you hear Alan Shaw say things like, we want to focus on safety, what do you think? What's the track record of not just Norfolk Southern, but the rail industry in general right now when it comes to safety?
Yeah, so there's the particular issue that Rebecca's been referencing a little bit, which is Norfolk Southern having a long history, especially over the past decade, of lobbying against proposed safety rules that, you know, oftentimes are pretty common sense, as well as being a member of the American Association of Railroads, which is a lobbying group that has also continuously fought safety rules. So we reported a story soon after the derailment about how Norfolk Southern, as early as 2007, was promoting a new updated braking system known as electronically controlled pneumatic brakes. Norfolk Southern actually equipped one of its trains with this new braking system, told investors that it had the potential to reduce stopping distances of trains by up to 60%. And yet they turned around in the 2010s when the Obama administration proposed rules requiring trains carrying crude oil, other hazardous materials, to be equipped with this braking system. Norfolk Southern turned around, lobbied really hard against it. Their lobbying group fought it. And ultimately, after the Obama administration issued a rule requiring certain trains to be retrofitted with this electronically controlled pneumatic braking system, the railroads helped get it repealed during the Trump years. So there are numerous sort of particular examples like this of Norfolk Southern fighting safety rules. In this case, it was sort of remarkable because the company had actually previously touted the technology, you know, for making trains safer. Then there's sort of the bigger picture issue, which is that this is an industry, and Norfolk Southern has been part of these trends, which has been returning most of its profits to shareholders in the form of stock buybacks and dividends, has not been making investments in updating its infrastructure, has slashed its workforces by nearly 30% in recent years as part of an efficiency program, which they're calling precision scheduled railroading. So this is not an industry that's sort of operating in a way that would sort of suggest it cares a lot about issues like staffing and upgraded technologies that would promote safety.
And Rebecca, in just the less than a minute before we take a break, how has the town been responding? Were they surprised that something like this could happen there?
I think people are understandably quite concerned. You know, there's a lot of fear and anxiety about the exposure. You know, as you noted, it's a small community of about 5,000 people with a freight line running through it. The sequence of events here where the derailment happened on a Friday evening, first responders reported that, you know, when they arrived on the scene, they could smell chemicals permeating the air, but had no available information about what chemicals they were dealing with. So the initial response really left a lot to be desired and just points to these kind of persistent safety issues that we've been talking about.
I'm going to pause Julia and Rebecca there. We're discussing the recent train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking about the recent train derailment in Ohio and what that tells us about the health of the rail industry in this country. My guests today are Rebecca Burns and Julia Rock. They're journalists at The Lever. And on February 8th, they published a long investigative piece on the state of the U.S. rail industry. And I want to begin here on a point that Julia was talking about, some of the regulations that were involved. On Tuesday, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg was asked about former President Donald Trump's visit to East Palestine. Buttigieg blamed the Trump administration for rolling back safety regulations.
Look, I don't know exactly what he's planning to do there, especially since his administration was anti-regulation and pro-industry every step of the way. There are a number of cases where regulations, including safety regulations and regulations that related to rail, were either watered down or frozen in place by his administration. But I don't know what he's planning to do there. I do know that we have work to do, that we've been underway on from day one of this situation. And while, you know, the politics will come and go and the grandstanding will come and go, we will be there for the long haul to make sure that this community is supported and to make sure that there's more accountability for the railroad industry in this country.
So, Rebecca, I want to put the politics aside in this discussion and talk about this regulation, the regulations that were rolled back during the Trump administration. Was there any effort to put them back in place during the Biden administration?
Right. So we haven't seen the Biden administration and specifically Secretary Buttigieg's transportation department move to try and reinstate the braking requirements that, you know, were repealed under President Trump, but that the Department of Transportation now does have the power to move to put back into place.
And so tell us a little bit more, Julia, about this regulation, particularly the one about the brakes. And also, after that, are there regulations involved in terms of what can be carried as cargo on these trains? But let's talk about this braking system first.
So there's this moment in the early 2010s when there's a huge increase in the amount of crude oil being shipped on freight trains, in part because of the Bakken oil boom in the U.S. And there was a high-profile train derailment involving a crude oil train in Canada in 2013 that left 47 people dead. And so there's sort of a moment like the one we're having right now of national attention on train derailments carrying, you know, flammable and hazardous materials. So the Obama administration proposed a set of rules that would have put stricter safety requirements on these trains carrying hazardous materials. However, as you know, we always see when the executive branch proposes regulations, corporate lobbyists sort of swarmed the rulemaking process. And so on the one side, you had the National Transportation Board, this federal agency that investigates transportation accidents, urging the Obama administration to adopt a very broad view of what a hazard, a high hazard flammable material was. That would mean that these safety regulations applied to a broader set of trains, including, you know, the train that just derailed in East Palestine, which was carrying vinyl chloride. On the other side, you had the chemical industry, as well as the oil and rail industries, lobbying for a very narrow definition of what type of train would be covered by this set of rulemaking. The Obama administration ultimately sided with the lobbyists over the National Transportation Board and adopted a somewhat narrow view of what would trigger this high hazard flammable train classification, such that the train that just derailed in East Palestine was not being regulated as a high hazard flammable train. The sort of biggest safety feature that this classification triggered was this retrofit requirement, requiring trains to be retrofitted in addition to with sort of better tanks with these electronically controlled pneumatic brakes, replacing the conventional air brake system that was designed in the 1860s that trains currently use. That was the part of the rule that the Trump administration went on to repeal.
And I want to talk a little bit about how officials have been responding to this. At a press conference in East Palestine on Tuesday, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, who's a Republican, said he was hopeful they could change regulations for trains that carry hazardous materials.
There is something fundamentally wrong when a train like this could come into a state and the current law does not require, despite what they were hauling, does not require them to notify the state or local officials. That simply has to be changed. The fact that this train did not qualify under current law, requiring the railroad company to make that notification, is just absurd. It makes absolutely no sense at all.
And Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro told NPR yesterday that it is vital that they work across party lines to hold Norfolk Southern accountable for their, quote, corporate greed, incompetence, and lack of care for our residents, end quote.
Governor DeWine's a Republican. I'm a Democrat. We're working together on this. I know there's been a lot of noise surrounding this from some outside players and noisemakers, but the reality is we are working together, not just on the cleanup, but we've also discussed presenting ourselves to Congress and letting Congress know the important steps they need to take to make our rails safer. And I think we can both obviously speak from experience on this, and I think this will be a bipartisan effort to force Congress to act.
So, Julia, we're going to talk a little bit later about what some solutions are and who is responsible for doing what. But help us understand, it probably seems surprising to the residents as well that there were not more disclosure regulations requiring communities to be prepared for what might happen with hazardous materials rolling through their towns. What is the state of the regulation there?
Yeah, so this is part of what Rebecca was talking about before as well, where first responders arrived on the scene and didn't know what chemicals this train was carrying. So part of that Obama rulemaking around high-hazard flammable trains was that it triggered certain disclosure requirements, such that trains carrying these materials through towns had to disclose what materials they were carrying. And there were some sort of fights around this disclosure as well, obviously. But because this train did not have the high hazard flammable train classification, it was not required to make those disclosures, which is how first responders ended up in a situation where they did not know what chemicals were on board.
So help us understand what's happening there now. Is it still, is there a cleanup effort underway? Are residents being provided in real time with the things that they need? I know there is concern about the safety of the water and of the air. Rebecca, give us an idea of what is happening there now. What does the response look like?
Right. So the Environmental Protection Agency has said that it will require Norfolk Southern to pay all cleanup costs. That's an important step. But what we typically see in, you know, these kind of industrial accidents is that the company at fault is very involved, both in the initial testing and then, you know, is moving to try and limit its costs, its scope of liability. And so, you know, testing is underway. We know from the EPA that indoor monitoring is happening in residents' homes. Soil sampling and water sampling is happening. I think a real concern, and the Huffington Post had a good piece about this over the weekend, is that, for example, some of the water sampling done by Ohio EPA was actually performed by a contractor hired by Norfolk Southern. So I think, again, you know, there's a lot of confusion and concern on the part of residents. I'm not in a position to speculate, you know, about the scope of contamination. But I will just say that, you know, based on how previous accidents like this have sort of played out, there is reason to be worried about trusting the railroad company to do, you know, the initial monitoring and then eventually to help determine how much it's responsible for.
Rebecca, do you have any idea how widespread the issue is when it comes to trains and the regulation of things such as what cargo they're carrying and the trains themselves, like with this braking system? How widespread of an issue is this? I mean, another Norfolk Southern train derailed in Detroit since this accident happened as well. Is this a bigger problem than just this one incident?
Right. So as Julia noted, there are about 1,000 derailments every year. That's sort of just the state of affairs. So while the total number of derailments has gone down since the 1970s, the number of accidents per mile has gone up. And we have also seen the damage specifically from accidents involving trains carrying hazardous materials going up. So, of course, you know, derailments can always have severe consequences, both for workers on board and for the surrounding communities. I think there's a particular concern when we have trains carrying, you know, oil, crude oil, and other hazardous materials. Even if those are somewhat rare, they are rarer than with trucks. The damage resulting from them can be quite severe.
Democratic Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown appeared on CNN's State of the Union with Pamela Brown this past Sunday, and he said something's got to change when it comes to regulating the rail industry.
I mean, that's why I'm angry when I look at these companies, lay people off. They never look out for their workers. They never look out for their communities. They look out for stock buybacks and dividends. Something's wrong with the corporate America, and something's wrong with Congress and administrations listening too much to corporate lobbyists.
Okay,
and
so let's talk about
that. That's got to change. I mean, that's the fight I make.
So, Julia, you mentioned earlier that you had been looking into employment issues, labor issues regarding the railroads. Kind of put those things together. What's the connection there?
Yeah, so there are many connections between the rail labor issues and safety. Sort of the overarching plot is this new management system that the railroads have been bringing in recent years, which they're calling precision scheduled railroading. And this has involved sort of a few symptoms, one of which is trains getting longer. Another symptom is sort of the slashing of the workforces. And, you know, as many people following the rail labor disputes in the fall might remember, you know, one byproduct of the workforce is being slashed is that workers can't get access to time off. They can't get paid sick days. Their scheduling is extremely erratic. They're exhausted. Trains are understaffed. Another issue that has come up is that inspection times for trains are falling. So one number I heard was that, you know, the inspection time for a train used to be 2 minutes. Now it's down to 30 seconds. So there are sort of all of these workforce staffing issues that have come out of precision scheduled railroading that, you know, have really obvious safety consequences.
And Senator Brown also mentioned things like stock buybacks. We've heard a lot of officials accuse the rail industry of greed. Rebecca, how does that connect, as far as your reporting goes, with what happened here?
Right. So I would say that the technological issues that we've been talking about and the labor issues are really sort of two sides of the same coin. That because railroads, including Norfolk Southern, have increasingly directed profits back to shareholders in the form of stock buybacks, they've really resisted making both needed technological upgrades and also just basic maintenance. They've also really resisted investing in a workforce, you know, that's fully staffed, that has time off, that's well rested. And both of these issues are sort of fundamental to the safety of our railroads.
On Tuesday, Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw toured East Palestine and told PBS that the rail company would do right by the town's citizens.
We're going to see this thing through. That's my commitment to the community of East Palestine. We're going to invest in the environmental cleanup. We have made a lot of progress. We've got air monitoring, water monitoring. We're coordinating with the Ohio EPA. We're continuing to provide financial assistance for the citizens of this community. So far, we've either reimbursed or committed $6.5 million to the citizens of this community, and that's a down payment. And we're going to invest in this community for the long haul to help this community recover and help this community thrive.
So, Rebecca, I want to start talking about where we go from here and who is responsible for what. And let's begin with Norfolk Southern. We heard the CEO there promising to be there for the community. Talk a little bit more about what its responsibility is. We mentioned earlier briefly that it's been told to be responsible to pay for cleanup costs. How does that work?
Right. So, like I said, it was a good step that the EPA came out and said that Norfolk Southern would be responsible if it fails to adhere to the work plan that's established. The EPA has said it will do the work itself and charge bill Norfolk Southern for triple the cost as a disincentive to sort of skip steps in the cleanup. But the exact cleanup plan, I believe, is still being determined. And that's going to be really crucial. And what we've seen sort of in some previous, you know, the aftermath of previous industrial accidents, there needs to be a comprehensive cleanup plan. This needs to have community input and be communicated to the community in a way that, you know, builds trust and understanding. There's also a lot of, you know, there's several putative class action lawsuits. I think another issue that we're going to run into here is just how far away contaminants reached, you know, and if someone who's across the border in Pennsylvania has negative health impacts, what's Norfolk Southern's responsibility to them?
All right, we will pick that up when we come back from a break. We are discussing the recent train derailment in Ohio and what the accident might reveal about the rules and regulations governing the rail industry in this country. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Tomorrow, we will be talking about midlife career changes, and we want to hear from you. Are you someone who has shifted careers late in life, or do you feel stuck in your current career? And what are you thinking about shifting toward? Is it something completely new? Either way, we want to hear from you and your third act. Tell us your story by recording a message on the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just search for the On Point Vox Pop app wherever you get your apps, or you can leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about the recent Norfolk Southern Trail derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. Julia Rock and Rebecca Burns are with me. They're journalists for The Lever, and they've been looking closely at the rules and regulations governing the rail industry. And now, also joining me from New York, is Stephen Cohen. He's program director of the Masters in Sustainability Management Program at Columbia University School of Professional Studies, where he is also the senior vice dean. He's also a former policy analyst and consultant to the EPA. He's been watching the government response to this train disaster. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So start by telling us, what is the EPA's role here? And in your opinion, do you think they're doing an effective job?
Well, they're ramping up, but they should have been ramping up much faster. Under Superfund, they have emergency response authority. And they should have been on scene, you know, within 24 hours and getting the EPA admit. And there were some EPA people there early, but they didn't invoke Superfund until yesterday and should have been done much earlier.
So explain to us what evoking that Superfund power does. What difference does that make?
Well, it provides emergency response authority. In other words, they are going to require... there's two parts of Superfund. One is remediation and one is emergency response. And under the emergency response part of the bill, they can go in and just start cleaning up. What they're requiring the company to do is the company's responsibility to clean up the site and all of its impact. Those are two different things. They should have been there at the very beginning. And what I'm particularly concerned about, I mean, the part of Superfund I worked on back in 1980 was developing the community relations program of engaging with locals. When I was in graduate school, we had this emergency at Love Canal down the road, and government's interactions with communities with toxics is horrible. and doesn't seem to have gotten better in the last 40 years. The initial response was first reassuring people prematurely and not really dealing with people's real worries and concerns and not doing it effectively. And I think that is really something EPA should have been doing literally from day one.
So EPA Administrator Michael Regan was in East Palestine on Tuesday. At a press conference, he said residents of the town would not be forgotten, and he said the EPA was ordering Norfolk Southern to pay for the cleanup.
Folks, I know this order cannot undo the nightmare that families in this town have been living with, but it will begin to deliver much-needed justice for the pain that Norfolk Southern has caused. I want the community to know that we have heard you and that we need to keep hearing from you. As much as our support on the ground will continue to be needed, we also need you. However long it takes, we're going to work to earn your trust. There's a long road ahead, but you will not have to walk that road alone. We're going to take this journey for justice together.
So, Stephen, can you talk a little bit more about what you mean about what the role of the EPA is to engage with the community here? What do you think they should be doing that you haven't seen yet?
Well, at the very start, they should have had people with expertise in toxics and social work, community relations people, sitting with the community, with the local officials, with the governor, and really mapping out a plan for addressing people's immediate concerns. I mean, the evacuation should have been done better. It also should have been done in a more organized way. It's not as if we've never seen a train derailment with explosions like this before. And every time you see one of these, it's like, oh, this is, it's a novel event. Well, it's not a novel event. There ought to be standard procedures of going in and responding very quickly to get people to safety and reassuring them that the damage will be cleaned up and their financial impact will be redressed. And, it just seems like every one of these actions is always treated like it's an emergency when it's actually should be treated fairly routinely, given the number of times it happens.
And Stephen, I just want to ask here, we've been talking about the EPA. We've also been talking about the Transportation Department. Mm-hmm. In your experience, do these agencies work together very well? It seems like in a circumstance like this, they would have to be.
Yeah, there is actually under Superfund, there is there are provisions for a variety of agencies to get together on emergency response. But I think that part of what's happened here is, the federal government, after, decades of attack on regulation, is pretty flabby when it comes to this kind of response. Local jurisdictions, I mean, I'd rather have the FDNY in New York respond to one of these things than EPA's regional office or their anybody coming out of the federal government. And I think that's really a problem, because these particular kind of accidents require a higher level of technical expertise.
So I want to talk a little bit more about where we go from here and who's responsible for what. We mentioned, Rebecca, earlier briefly, the fact that class action lawsuits have been filed. We know that that's probably in the earliest of stages at this point, and that can take a long time to resolve. But what are these lawsuits seeking? And tell us how that fits into what may happen at this point forward.
Right. So I haven't reviewed all of the lawsuits, but, speaking generally, they'll be seeking damages both for personal injury and damages to property. So, for example, there's an Airbnb owner in East Palestine who feels, pretty reasonably that she won't be able to continue that business. Other issues like this, where the scope of the damage sort of stretches beyond the immediate health and environmental questions.
And Julia, one of the things, aside from fear about the drinking water and the air that we've heard some of the residents talk about sort of gets to that point. The economy of this town, if people move away, that can have a really devastating impact. Is there any sense as to who, what can be done about that, or who might be responsible for helping life in this town return to normal?
Well, so as Rebecca was suggesting with the class action lawsuits, I think there's sort of like a broad scope of damages that obviously come out of an incident like this that are, that, you know, will presumably be resolved or not be resolved through litigation. I know Governor DeWine had mentioned like potentially bringing charges against the company, but there hasn't, you know, obviously been any movement on that yet. EPA also has said, you know, if the company doesn't clean things up properly, they can face fines of up to $70,000 per day. If the National Transportation Board finds that there were violations of hazardous material rules, the company can be fined for that. So I think there's sort of a broad scope of both potential fines from regulators as well as what might come out of these lawsuits in terms of accountability. But, you know, obviously many of those things can also fall short.
Peter DiCarlo of Johns Hopkins University is an atmosphere scientist, and he told PBS that the EPA needs to do a better job gathering data on air safety in and around East Palestine.
So the EPA is providing monitoring and stationary sampling data. The monitoring data is from these handheld monitors that are really not designed to measure outside air quality. I believe these are also the instruments they're using to screen people's homes and let people know that it's safe to move back. As an atmospheric measurement person, I would not feel comfortable with that level of screening. I would want more information. I'd want to know what chemicals were present. And so that, by the EPA's definition, would require air sampling, which means you take air into a stainless steel container, you take that back to a lab, and you do much more detailed measurements and characterization of what chemicals are present and at what concentrations. And that's the type of information that's needed to know that the air is safe.
So, Stephen, let's talk a little bit more specifically about the testing that's being done and how residents can be confident that the information that they're getting is accurate and sufficient, given criticisms like this, that what the EPA is doing in real time isn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the criticism. And I also think that people have been prematurely reassured that everything's okay. I mean, frankly, we saw that here in New York after 9/11, same exact thing. And, you know, people have been getting sick for, you know, decades since then. So I think that this is a deep problem. This idea that we want to reassure people so everything can get back to normal as fast as possible. But I think what you need to do instead is very rapidly do the kind of testing you were just hearing described. Do it over time. Get it peer reviewed. Get it reviewed independently. So it's not somebody like the government or like the company that has a vested interest in putting things back together as fast as possible, and create a level of trust that, okay, now it really is real and things are okay. I think that really this sort of rush to judgment is the heart of the problem here, because you always find out later on it wasn't true, and then you mistrust everything. And I think the absence of trust here is at the center of our problem in how you frame a response to a catastrophe like this.
And Stephen, we have seen this incident get swept up in a political battle over and above the discussion that we are having here. Just given your experience, how much more difficult, if at all, does it make the work of the regulators, of the train company, how much difficult does the work they have to do become given the politicization that has happened around this issue?
Yeah, it makes it much, much harder. I mean, watching Trump there, who's responsible for much of the deregulation that we're dealing with now, was kind of absurd. But I do think that there was an opportunity early on where the president and the Secretary of Transportation and the EPA administrator should have gotten there within 48, 72 hours and shown some commitment, and that didn't happen. So that's a lost opportunity. But this, the ideology makes it really hard because the science itself is hard. There's a lot of uncertainty. It's difficult to know exactly what safety means in some of these cases. And once you add to that this, conspiracy stuff and the online stuff, it just makes it ridiculous.
So, Julia, tell us what the administration is empowered to do now. We started about talking about regulations that had been rolled back. Could the administration put these regulations back? What would that process look like?
Yeah, so obviously, in some ways, the politicization of the event has obscured the roles of people like, President Donald Trump in deregulating this industry. But I think it's also worth noting that this is sort of an intensely political event. What allows a train like this, to run through a town without making disclosures about what chemicals are on board is the product of politics. It's the product of lobbying and rulemaking. So now the Department of Transportation has broad authority through the different sub-agencies, including the Federal Railroad Administration, to issue rules and regulations that make railroads safe. So one thing that Transportation Secretary Buttigieg could do is revive these rules that he criticized Trump for repealing around electronically controlled pneumatic braking. That specific braking rule was repealed after Congress included a measure in a 2015 transportation bill at the urging, of course, of the railroad industry, requiring a cost-benefit analysis for the braking provision in particular. And the cost-benefit analysis sort of came up, again, under industry influence, finding that the costs outweighed the benefits of the new brakes. The analysis was later pretty thoroughly debunked by an Associated Press investigation. So Pete could do his own rules around ECP braking, or he could move to redo that cost-benefit analysis, which lawmakers and environmental groups had called for at the time, and try to revive the same rule. So there are sort of lots of different avenues. There are, of course, other rules. He's currently considering a two-man crew rule, which basically has to do with staffing on trains, although his own version of the rule has been criticized by some of the railroad unions. But there's really broad authority in the Transportation Department to regulate the railroads with the aim of safety.
And we have about a minute left, Rebecca. Above that, is there something for others to do? Does Congress need to act? Do there need to be better rules or more clarifying of the rules that exist?
Right. So I think a really sort of key broad takeaway here for Congress, for regulators, is to really listen to the alarms that rail workers have been trying to raise, including in the contract negotiations last fall, which were, approximately about paid sick days, but also much broader issues of safety and staffing. So different rail unions have recommended a range of measures, sort of ranging from public ownership of the railroads to very practical and immediate steps that could be required, such as making mandatory the railroads' participation in a close call reporting system so that regulators have a heads up earlier on when they're near misses and steps need to be taken to make things safer.
Rebecca Burns is a reporter for The Lever. Thank you for joining us, Rebecca.
Thanks, Kimberly.
Julia Rock is also a reporter for The Lever. Thank you for joining us, too.
Yeah, thanks a bunch.
And Stephen Cohen, Program Director of the Master's in Sustainability Program at Columbia University School of Professional Studies. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.